Accession number 33250, reel 7.
That's his one again.
Yes.
Sir John Wilton, reel 7.
We came down again to no, I can't remember the name of the place. Anyway, we came down onto the positions from which we would move if and when the assault on Casino took place. And the conditions were similar to those in the approach to the positions that we left. That is to say, there was no movement by day unless a heavy smoke screen was laid, which it was whenever it was required. Ghastly stuff to have to live in a cloud of chemical smoke. But anyway,
Would you be putting those screens down? The water platoon, I mean.
No. This was done by the artillery. Oh yes. No, we would not have wished to attract attention to our position by letting off mortars. So they were. I mean, the approach to Casino from the positions up to the right, which we had left, which we had just been occupying. I mean, that entire operation was conducted in a smoke screen. There was about 8 miles of the supply train, the supply route was about 8 miles long, of which some could be done by vehicle, but the last bit had to be done by mules. It was all done at night. There was a stretch just before you stopped on the end of the vehicle thing called the Mad Mile. You drove like hell and hoped for the best. And there was it was similar now that in a way the flow was reversed. How were we and the others going to be supplied down here to the left to cross the river and so on? And again, it was no movement by day and very cautious movement by night and so on. It was one of the continuing unpleasantnesses was the rotting of the dead mules and so forth. You never really got used to the stench of death. But at least it wasn't like the First World War where you lived with it in the trenches. We at least had a little better than that. The problems, I mean, up there on the top, no latrines, stink of dead mule always, and another man who distinguished himself while the brigade was in that position was Dan Kelleher, the padre of the Irish Fusiliers. Who would, as a matter of routine almost, go out to carry back anybody who was wounded or anything like that. He took no precautions whatsoever, I mean, except to watch where he was treading. I mean, he didn't even wear a steel helmet, but he was always there to talk to and to help any wounded and get them back and so on. And he got a military cross for his goal there. He was a marvellous man too, and a great eye for a horse. And when at the end of the war the season of horse worship set in, Dan was in great demand, picking winners. I don't mean in races, I mean that one would be worth having. No, don't bother with that Spavin nag, you know. I mean, he was a great man. Liverpool Irish. Right. You asked about mortars up on the top, you know, could mortars be used at all? They weren't used by the battalion on the top thing, but they were used by the battalions lower down, who were on a reverse slope and consequently did not attract immediate retribution. I mean, the thing about mortars, you don't want to be seen. Anyway, when we came down from, we handed over to the Poles, who were to do the final attack, and very determined lot they were. The name of the place I couldn't remember, where we went back for more training and so forth while we waited for the next development, was Formicola. During that period, as many as possible got leave, and we went back to the that idyllic bit of coast down by Capri, you know, the bit facing Capri, the blue
Brown grotto. Sort of area.
Yes, yeah. Blue, the blue grotto, and oh dear, I shall remember in due course. But we the division established various rest houses. All sorts of people volunteered. We were invited to stay in the house of a marquesa who had a large villa there with a lemon orchard and a horse which she rode along the beach every day. And you know, it was very nice. And while you were there, you could get a box of lemons, half a dozen really beautiful lemons, perfect lemons. There was a very good system set up for mailing them home. I sent my box of lemons home, where they were a sensation, of course. My mother auctioned one of the lemons for the Red Cross. She was working in the Red Cross. She auctioned one of the lemons for the Red Cross, and it fetched 10 shillings for a lemon. Well, you've got to pay that nowadays anyway. But in those days, that was something quite different. So there we got our leave. And on the 10th of May, I was promoted there to captain, which and took over as the second in command of A company, the duties of the second in command were to stay alive until the company commander got wounded or killed, and to go up and take over. Meanwhile, making yourself useful in any way that you could, you know, helping with anything that that could be done. The thing started the following day, May the 11th. Again, 1,600 guns in the barrage, twice Alamein, plus, of course, the continual aerial bombardment and cover. which, as I said, as others have pointed out, in the end, turned out to be self-defeating in that it made it impossible to get tanks through the town of Cassino. You know, the road was impassable via, it was flooded and ploughed. But by dawn on the 12th of May, the bridgehead across the river had been established, which meant that the 78th Division advance could start, and the Irish Brigade, needless to say, were allowed to go first. The Inniskillens led the advance over the Bailey Bridge, which the engineers had managed to get across, and meanwhile on the left the French also attacked across the river, and once they got across the river they unleashed, as the order of the day said, they unleashed the Gooms, the Moroccan troops, who just being lightly armed and so on, moved with great speed and really quite astonished the Germans, who wondered what the hell was happening. I think that was a good move, but make yourself useful in any way you can. Once we got across the river, one of the things that we were able to do, we found a German tank and abandoned. I mean, there was this tank, and I said, I wonder if it will go, you know, and some mechanic or some chap said, I'll see, and got in, and it started up. So well, that's useful. We got a heavy tow chain, and we pulled several vehicles through the mud, which had got stuck during the advance. We did quite a little recovery business for a day or two, till we ran out of fuel. And you know, I mean, that was something. Well, I don't know what I haven't really prepared any more much. No, there we are, the brigade. And indeed the division did sweep round. They did cut Route 6, but unfortunately not before the Germans got away, and we had to pursue them all the way to Rome and beyond.
What was your involvement in that sweep around Cassino?
Nothing. I mean, I simply followed with the B echelon, as they say.
Were you left out of battle?
Yes. I did nothing actually by way of combat until after Rome. We got to Lake Trasimeno. Well, there it is. We followed the thing, as I say. You made yourself useful if you could, if there was anything that could be sent forward, any messages, any this, any that. But that was it. When we got beyond Rome. There was a bit more fighting, and the Germans were prepared again to hold a line, just at Trasimeno, Lake Trasimeno, which has another one of these confounded places. Village at the end was a village with up on a hill that looked down on the whole thing, the lake and everything beside it. So it was that was a problem. Now the that was the point at which my company commander in some fighting in a village called Pucciarelli was wounded, and he got a bullet through his wrist and was removed to hospital, and I was told to go and take over the company. I was getting ready to go and take over the company when an extraordinary figure appeared. This was the corporal, the beefy corporal, who was standing about 5 degrees out of the perpendicular like this, and I said, "Yes, well, what can I do for you, corporal?" "I want a commissario." And I said, no, you can't. The reason he was standing like this was because a bullet had passed between the sole of his boot and the sole of his foot. He had got a considerable burn he couldn't put his foot to the ground. But no, I want a commissario. So I said, "Well, no, you'll have to stay here until you can walk." It doesn't make sense. And I climbed into the jeep and I was away. He came up the next day with the ration truck. You couldn't keep that man out of a fight if there was a fight going on, you know. Anyway. When I got to Pucciarelli, the Germans were still in it. We were a matter of yards apart. They had not gone away, they had not given up. And the first night was very rowdy. They raided, they counterattacked the village. But we were able to hold them off, and they went away. Then they did pull out. Then, as a result of as they did not just walk back in and find or dispose of us, we kept them out. So for the next day or so, it was the case of inching forward here, moving a bit there, and so on, until we came to yet another river, which was really no more than a stream, but anyway, it was in quite a deep riverbed of its own, and it flowed down into the lake, I mean, our orders were quite simply to advance on this front. We were the right hand of the division moving up the left bank of the lake, and we had in support some Canadian tanks, the Three Rivers Regiment, one of the French Canadian lot, also very good, and we advanced with the tanks, and any time anything moved, the tanks would give it a bang, this is the sort of warfare that one likes, until of course the mortar bombs and the things come over as they try to stop you. But anyway, we didn't stop. We went on, and our objective was the bank looking down on the river, and on the top of the of this thing that we were headed for was a farmhouse, and the Canadians fired a few rounds into the farmhouse, and I said, "Oi, oi, you know, we're hoping to live there for a day at least. You know, don't knock it down completely." Well, better be safe than sorry. So off we went again, this was too much for the chaps there. Seeing the tanks and everything coming up, they decided to pull back, and they did, except for two who remained in sort of underground in dugouts. They were protected from things like tank fire and so forth, but they weren't going to fight. They just came out when once we arrived, there they were. Well, we stayed there, the only thing was that the tanks, one tank went over to see what was in front of us. He shouldn't have done that. He should have said, when you go over there and tell us it's clear, we'll move. But meanwhile, we're going to stay behind the hill. That tank was hit by a shot from a German tank, probably a Tiger. So that was a tank written off, which was bad. The second tank, which was up on the top of the crest beside the house, he had his lid open, and he was having a look to see what was happening, when a ping, as a smaller, but fortunately, hit his lid, so he hurriedly closed that down and backed off to the woods, which were behind. There was a bit of a woods behind, and he said that he would he'd come back when he needed to, you know, when we needed him. But meanwhile, he had to get his tanks out of the way of this gun. We sat there for nearly 24 hours. No, less than that. It was the afternoon. We started at dawn. We were there by the midday. The next brigade passed through us at that evening, and that was the end of that battle, so far as I was concerned. The sad thing was that one of the tank shells which they had fired at the farm had broken the leg of an ox, those great white oxen. Now they'd got a broken leg. Nothing they could do. They just had to kill the thing. But it's not easy to, not all that easy to kill. And when they'd killed it, they couldn't get it out. It was in the stable on the ground floor stable with a normal setup. And there they had a dead ox. Anyway, we were going, and I don't know whether they managed to butcher it, eat it, or what, but that was sad. It's always rotten when you see a farm, a peasant's living like that, so heavily damaged. It's the old grandma who was up upstairs was sitting nursing a basket of eggs, the first chaps in there were looking at the eggs rather hungrily, you know, and the old lady says, I finally got the message. These eggs were, she was keeping the eggs warm, they were going to hatch. So no use to eat anyway. For God's sake, don't now destroy the chicks as well. So we left the old lady with her eggs and her shawl. But we were then eventually, in a day or so, we were taken out of the line, and we went back to just south of the lake, where harvest was in full swing, and a lot of our chaps, who were country boys, said, "Well, can we give them a hand?" I said, "Sure, give them a hand, you know, by all means, if you know what to do." They worked a very good system, the farms. You know, you come and get my harvest in today, and lunch is here, and we'll go and get yours in tomorrow, and lunch is there, and so, you know. Our chaps were all in there bringing in the wheat, and were invited to lunch. Jolly good, you know. I mean, it was just chicken and polenta, but jolly good chicken and polenta. Nothing against chicken and polenta. Anyway, so from then on, it was back to Rome, where we had a party. The brigadier commandeered the Barberini Palace for the occasion, and the Irish Brigade beat retreat on the terrace, and we had a dance and a ball and so forth. After which, back to Egypt.
Did you have a chance to meet the Pope? Or?
Yes, we did. Dan Kelleher was very good about it. He took all his lads to see the Pope. And he said, "Would it be all right if he were now to bring some of the some of the infidels as well? You know, so anybody who wanted to go was able then to go to." We didn't actually meet the Pope. We were present in the chamber through which he passed. You know, oh dear, now it's this battery down. This was a daily occurrence. Of course, the numbers were enormous. We were it was Father Dan who got us onto the list. That was an extraordinary event. The room was packed. There were people, especially American people, hanging from the window, you know, up on the windowsill, hanging onto the thing with one hand and flashing their camera through the other. And the old boy was quite imperturbable as he was carried in on his high chair thing, you know. And he gave us a blessing, and we were all given a little medal as we left. And I didn't say that while we were in Tunis, we made the acquaintance of a family that lived just near where we were camped. A very nice French family. He was the interpreter to the Bey. His wife was, and he had a daughter, about 13 years of age, something like that. And so when I got my medal, I thought, oh dear, I have I have intercepted a blessing. So I said, perhaps if your daughter would be you know, delightful. Many songs we see protest on. We are not Catholics, we are Protestants. So I was, however, I had handed over the medal by then, and I didn't say, oh, well, in that case, I'll have it back. Very nice. After
I'll just stop there for a minute.